When it comes to teaching young people about race relations and racism, children of color get the talk at a much younger age.
White families need to grow anti-racist conversations with our white kids.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll discuss the need for educating all children of all races about the way we interact in a diverse society. We'll also spend an academic minute with historic artwork depicting African-American farmers. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The concept of a post-racial world has pretty much gone out the window, at least for the foreseeable future. Students of all ages will have to deal with the reality of racial differences as part of the growing up process, and the more we can prepare them for that reality will go a long way towards helping young people cope with the situations they have to deal with as they grow up in the U.S. That's my not-so-comprehensive analysis of Dr. Jennifer Harvey's new book called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. Dr. Harvey is a professor of ethics at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. I asked her why she took on this project.
Well, I took on this project because I've been committed to anti-racist activism for about 20 years as a white American in particular, and, you know, constantly working to understand what that means. And I realized about 5 or 6 years ago, you know, when I became a mom, that just because I was constantly working in and learning how to do anti-racism work across racial lines as a white person, it didn't mean I necessarily knew what I needed to be saying to and teaching and modeling for a one-year-old, a two-year-old, a three-year-old. And I realized there were a lot of other white adults who were also attempting to be committed to racial justice work who were similarly asking questions about, at what age do we talk to our kids about police brutality against black people and these kinds of questions. And I realized that there were just lots of white parents who had the same questions I did, and I wanted to think seriously about doing a better job with my kids than my parents had done with me despite their best intentions.
I know this book was written with parents in mind, but I want to talk about an incident in school first. What happens when a teacher in a class stands up and starts to talk about race? What's the reaction among the students?
Well, it depends on the age of the students, but if we're talking about late teens, or in my experience, you know, young college students, often students of color are ready to go and are, great, let's have this conversation. And in my experience, white students panic and look like deer in headlights and start thinking, hey, could we talk about abortion? That would be so much easier. And what I realize is that young white adults or older teens have just had very little explicit and healthy conversations about race in their families, and so they're just not prepared to have the kinds of conversations that our society deeply needs if we're going to move the needle on race to be better than we are right now in terms of the racial climate.
It seems that children of color have to have the talk about race at a much earlier age.
They do. And white parents, you know, I realize that if I don't teach my 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old a parallel version of the talk for them as a white child, that they will be unable to sustain meaningful friendships across racial lines. Because if my kids' friends are learning, hey, police are complicated and here's all of these things you need to know about encounters with police as a black young person, my white young person won't be able to be a good ally, won't be able to be a good friend. Ultimately, over time, that friendship will erode if she doesn't understand that there's this reality that her peers and her friends are living with. That's just one example, but there's so many examples of the ways that white families need to grow anti-racist conversations with our white kids so that they can remain connected and in meaningful friendships and relationships across racial lines.
There is a term that parents use. They want to be colorblind, colorblind parents. This doesn't seem to be working, does it?
It really doesn't, for a number of reasons. One reason colorblind teaching doesn't work is that it's just not a possibility. I mean, we are not neurologically wired not to notice difference. And so it's just like imposing a falsehood. It's like pointing at the sky and telling your child, well, that sky, maybe that sky is green, when your kid is learning everywhere else that the sky is blue. And the other reason it doesn't work is because people of color in the U.S. have said over and over and over, my race matters to me, my racial identity is important to me, I want it to be noticed, I want it to be celebrated and affirmed. And so it, colorblind teaching also ignores this message that communities of color have given to white people over and over. But the most insidious thing about colorblindness is that it teaches our kids, usually what we're doing is saying, hey, see that black person, see that Latino person, we just value everyone the same. Don't notice their race, which sends this sort of insidious negative message as if like, oh, overlook their race. Don't hold that against them. They're just as good as we are. And so colorblind teaching actually, without meaning to, I think white parents often have good intentions, colorblind teaching sort of implies to our children that there's something wrong with having dark skin. And so actually it can double down on negative views of people of color. And so it's really a deep problem in terms of a parenting strategy.
It seems in the book you describe the opposite of that is race-conscious parenting. What's that all about?
So race-conscious parenting is a little bit like teaching our kids that we need to value, notice, and affirm difference, which is a way of talking about diversity that we more and more are embracing in school contexts and many family contexts. Like, oh, we want to value diversity, and diversity is a good that we want our kids to celebrate. Race-conscious parenting does notice and value difference, and so we don't pretend that we don't notice race. We don't pretend that race is not a good thing to notice, but it does more than that. Race-conscious parenting also says, even while we're going to teach our children to notice difference, talk about difference, celebrate the differences that people of color name and lift up about their own selves and their own histories and their own communities, I also need to teach my child about the reality of racism in the world and about racism in the United States, because race-conscious parenting, the central goal of it is I want to raise an anti-racist committed child. And so I can only raise a child who's committed to anti-racism and feels like he or she has some skills around anti-racism, feels like they know how to intervene or challenge racism when they see it, if they actually learn what racism is. And so race-conscious parenting values diversity, but also is committed to teaching our kids the truth about racial challenges and racial injustice in the United States so that they can become agents of change, committed to justice and partnering with others to work for racial justice.
Is this race-conscious parenting and teaching the same as teaching the difference between genders?
You know, that's a really interesting question, Bob. It's complicated because actually I think one of the things about race-conscious parenting, and it gets at this paradox of race, is that on the one hand, I want my kids to notice race, notice difference, and affirm it. Not pretend that they don't notice race and racial difference. But on the other hand, here's the tricky thing about noticing race is we also know, and I don't want my kids to make assumptions about people based on their race. So I don't want my child to say, oh, look, that African-American person there, because they're African-American, I can assume X, Y, or Z about them. And so race-conscious parenting has this tricky dynamic to it. And I think that's a little bit like what gender does, because on the one hand, gender is complicated. You know, we do talk about, you know, girls celebrating being girls. We talk about wanting to affirm women, you know, in sort of anti-sexist ways. And we also talk about this complicated thing where, what does gender even mean, right? So I have a child who's a daughter, but if she shows up in the world committed to X, Y, and Z, does that mean she's a boy-like girl? I don't know. I mean, gender's complicated and race is complicated. And so there's some ways there's parallels there, and there's some ways that the parallel has to do with how we have to be cautious about making assumptions about people based on gender or race, even while we want to affirm and recognize and celebrate the identities that people claim.
It came to mind because of an incident you talked about in the book, where as a young lady said, you know, girls can't be doctors. To her doctor mother.
Yeah, my mom's a doctor, a medical doctor, which is unusual for her generation. And when I was about four, someone said, Jenny, you want to be a doctor when you grow up? And I looked them dead in the eye and I said, girls can't be doctors, they can only be nurses, which my mom thought was really funny. But, you know, that story says volumes about how much isms are in the air. In that case, you know, it took, you know, even having a mother doctor, it hadn't overridden my absorbing the sexism of the climate I was in. And that's the other reason that race-conscious parenting is so important, is that our children, all of our children, not just white children, are constantly being bombarded with racist images, racist structures, so they don't necessarily see people of color in leadership or teaching or as doctors, because we live in such unjust structures. And so we have to actively teach against that, work against that, if we want our children to grow anti-racist sensibilities.
There's an incident you talk about that happened when you were a young school person forming a white girls club with and you had a certain teacher who didn't take kindly to that.
That's right. When I was in first grade, I was in Denver Public Schools, and we were under mandated busing for desegregation. So I, you know, most of my elementary years, I was in classrooms that were at least 50% or more kids of color. And my little white friend one day in first grade said, "Hey, Jenny, we should start a white girls club." And when I looked confused, she said, "Well, you know, because we're only one of six white girls in the class." And our teacher, who was also white, happened to overhear this conversation. And just as I was kind of reckoning, going, looking, thinking, "Oh, yeah, I am a white girl." And, you know, but before I could kind of absorb this kind of new awareness, our teacher, you know, snapped it off and just said, "Girls, I don't ever want to hear you talk like that again." And so what I knew was we'd done something wrong. I didn't know what, but I knew that something about this sort of notion of skin color and race was scary. And what's so important about that story, Bob, is that white adults have so much anxiety about race and about what we are sometimes feeling stuck with, how to talk to our children about race, that like my first grade teacher, you know, she didn't mean probably to shut down and create a lot of silence in my experience around race, but she did because she was so anxious. And I really want parents and caregivers who have white children in their lives to learn to take a deep breath and think, what's the long-term hope here? If the long-term hope is to raise children and teenagers and young people who can navigate diverse spaces in healthy ways and who can behave in anti-racist committed postures for the good of all of us, then I've got to figure out how to get over my own anxiety and teach into that. And I wish my first grade teacher had felt like she had the skills to do that.
Still to come, our conversation with Jennifer Harvey continues with a look at the racial scripts that we all live by. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Harvey, a professor of ethics at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. We're talking about her new book called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. In the book, she devotes an entire chapter to what she calls racial scripts.
So racial scripts, to my mind, have to do with this way that race is a larger story. It's like a larger play, and the lines for the script are often being written by people that, you know, in ways that we don't necessarily have control over. And it's a play that was started long before I got here. So as a white American, this is the way I think about it, that, you know, I did anti-police brutality organizing in New York City in the 90s. I learned to do that by just participating with people of color who were leading that work. But when I'm walking down the street in Des Moines, Iowa, and it's the day after another African-American person has been killed by police, when I encounter that person on the street who doesn't know me, the fact that I did organizing in the 90s against police brutality does not, you know, that person doesn't know that. Those wounds, that trauma, that violence is in the air between us. It's part of the script that we're living in as a black person and a white person. And one of the things white Americans, I think, need to better understand, myself included, is that it doesn't matter if we're sort of like a good white person, whatever that means. We need to understand that these larger scripts are impacting our relationships across racial lines, and we need to learn to interrupt those scripts by committed anti-racist behaviors. And we also need to realize those scripts are operative in our kids' lives. And so there's racial tensions in multiracial elementary schools, whether we like it or not. Our kids feel the racial tensions that adults are living. They also are living in these larger scripts. And so we need to figure out ways to equip them by lots of race-conscious teaching and mentoring and modeling so that they can lean in and disrupt those scripts themselves.
It's interesting you point out in the book that you'll see some young children very interracially playing with each other, but by middle school there are segregated lunch tables.
Yes, and sociologists and psychologists have studied this a lot. It's very predictable that kids start to self-segregate by middle school. And a lot of times parents, especially white parents, are like, oh my gosh, what's going on? I don't understand this. And there's lots of pieces of it, but one goes back to the question you asked about, for example, the talk. You know, if white middle schoolers, because their parents or caregivers have insulated them from understanding racism or from thinking about and learning about what some of their friends of color might be experiencing on a daily basis in the world as they do encounter racist situations, over time, those friendships are going to erode. And so white kids are going to sit separately and black kids are going to sit separately because their racial experiences are just so different. But I don't think we have to accept that. I think we could teach white youth by starting very, very young to understand their own relationship to racial injustice differently and be able to sustain those friendships across racial lines by doing a better job in equipping them in the language and the learning of race and racism and, most importantly, anti-racism.
With all the attention that's being paid, and of course there's social media now, has the word racism lost its impact? Do we need to find another way to talk about this?
You know, that's such a good question, and I don't know if it's lost its impact or if it's long been, you know, wrongly used. It's come to have this idea that racism is just about one's intentions, and if my intentions were pure, then surely I'm not racist. And I really think that Beverly Daniel Tatum's use of racism when she talks about systems of unearned advantage and undeserved disadvantage, that if we could use that descriptive language, it would help us have better conversations about race. But I don't know how, you know, I don't want to just walk away from the word racism because the word makes white people uncomfortable. We need white folks to be willing to engage the discomfort of that. But I do think on the flip side of that, that word sort of what it brings to mind in public space is so simplistic relative to what are really deep layered systems of injustice. And, you know, even if I do have the best intentions, I still am embedded in a racist system, whether I want to be or not. And so unless I'm actively fighting that system and challenging that system, then I'm absolutely part of a racist society and then complicit. And so I'm not sure how we do a better job finding language that gets at that without trying to soften the conversation, because I don't think that can't be the goal either, just to soften the conversation.
Well, talking about, though, that let's go back to what your teacher did, you know, saying, you know, the White Girls Club, not a good idea, shouldn't do that. Would your teacher, do you think, have felt as comfortable saying that outside of school in a different and more social setting where she wasn't an authority figure? And should she have?
Yeah. So, you know, I've tried to think, what would I have wanted her to do? Like, and yeah, I mean, I think in an outside space where she wasn't an authority figure, depending on who she overheard saying that, the responses might be different because she might not really know what was going on in that very provocative exchange between two six-year-old white girls. And so, yeah, I don't think the response might have been the same. But in the context of a school where she knows these six-year-old girls, she knows her classroom, I think, man, what a moment for an adult. In this case, it's a teacher, but something similar could happen with a parent or a grandparent or a coach. Say, hey, you know what, let's talk about why are you thinking about a white girls club? Like, where did that come from? And what are you noticing about race in our classroom? And could we talk together as a whole class about these different understandings we might have about who we are and what our skin color is like and what our identity is? And I think a teacher could take that overheard conversation as information that, oh, I need to be proactively inviting the whole class to have some really meaningful conversations about difference. What blows my mind is that when we engage young children, even really young children, five-year-olds, by asking them questions about what they notice and experience in terms of race, it sometimes blows my mind what kids will say that many times adults just never get to have conversations with them about because we underestimate what our kids are already thinking about. And so I think a teacher could do that in a multiracial classroom in ways that would build the classroom's sense of community and interrupt the scripts in the process. The script became like, oh, race is scary, let's not go there. And by the time, you know, I was in fifth, sixth grade, guess what? I was in segregated lunch tables too. So I think she could have leaned in, and I think more adults need to do that.
So in the end, what does a healthy white kid look like, and how do we get there without also teaching guilt?
Yeah, I think a healthy white kid, I mean, it's a complicated notion, healthy, in a racially unjust society, but healthy means my kids don't pretend that race isn't something they see, and on the paradoxical flip side, they don't also make assumptions about race based on what someone's identity is. A healthy white kid is a child who understands they are white, but is very comfortable and able in their own skin to be in very multiracial spaces and engage in a human-to-human kind of way without sort of dominating as a white person and having false notions of somehow being superior, but also not sort of feeling like they need to shrink just because they're white. And most importantly, a healthy white kid is a child who understands what racism is, recognizes it when they see it, and has a commitment to the value of anti-racism along with some skills that they feel like they're able to implement when they see racism so that they can challenge it or intervene. And that's sort of a whole package that we need to build over time. For some white kids, like lots of white adults, white guilt may be a stage children hit along the way because, you know, my 8-year-old once asked me, hey, did European Americans only ever do bad things? And then she said, and are we a European American? Which was kind of funny because she already knew we were white. And I noticed, oh, that's her white guilt moment. And my response was, yes, this is, let's learn more about this history, and we can be anti-racist agents for racial justice to work against some of the ways our own ancestors have participated in legacies of harm. And so we can move children through white guilt if we work and partner with them on anti-racist agency. And so that's the goal, not to avoid guilt. Sometimes that's a developmentally normal response, but we don't want kids to get stuck there, just like we don't want adults to be stuck there.
I only have one more thing here. I just want you to tell the story of song number 19.
Yes. So song number 19 was a song on a Disney disc that my child had when she was little. And it was the One Little, Two Little, Three Little Indian song, and it had the, you know, hooping on it, and just a racist, offensive song relative to Native American identities and communities. And so my partner and I used to hit skip every time it got to song 18, thinking, well, we don't want to hear this racist song. And of course, one day I'm walking through the house and I overhear her, of course, singing the song. And this is one of those moments that I sort of panicked and thought, how do I talk to my 3-year-old about why she shouldn't be singing that song? Do I talk about genocide? Do I talk about colonization? What does that look like in 3-year-old speak? And like I sometimes encourage other white parents to do, I had the wherewithal to sort of take a deep breath and not sort of jump and say, hey, H, stop singing that song. Instead, I kind of waited. I gave myself a few hours to think it through, what I wanted to say to her, what I didn't want yet to say to her, and mostly gave myself some space to figure out how to have an invitational conversation with her where I drew us together into dialogue as opposed to sort of shutting her down by implying too fast that she'd done something wrong. And so I did that, and we ended up, you know, talking about why Native peoples don't want that song sung, and that was a great way to handle it, was with a 3-year-old. But mostly it was this lesson for me around taking a deep breath and going, okay, how do I translate this, give myself some time and come back to the conversation? And that's something I think a lot of white parents need encouragement to do, is to realize our anxiety that we are going to screw it up and get it wrong when it comes to race and anti-racism. We need to sort of take a deep breath through that anxiety and realize we have, as long as we keep the conversation going and keep feeding it in anti-racist ways, that's the work we are called to, I think, as parents.
Again, the name of Dr. Jennifer Harvey's new book is Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. There were millions of African-American farmers in the U.S. at the turn of the 20th century, but you wouldn't know it looking at the artwork of the era. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The work of black farmers can be underrepresented. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Sid Carpenter, professor of studio art, explores how art can help fill the gaps.
In the early years of the 20th century, there were 1 million African Americans farming in southern states. Today, they're estimated to be less than 35,000, largely because of the effects of slavery, sharecropping, and predatory government practices that diminished these numbers. Some have predicted there will be none by mid-century. This would be a devastating outcome if the story were to end here, but it does not. Although many African Americans left behind farms during the Great Migration north and west, they did not abandon the sense of self-sustainability, productivity, and beauty located in farming and gardening. When opportunity arose, they created gardens in backyards and on reclaimed city property. The current resurgence in urban farming sees African Americans as leaders, revitalizing communities through gardening. Also, African Americans are returning to family farms, reclaiming their heritage. My research revealed that very few artists have made work about black farmers. In response, I traveled to gardens in Georgia and South Carolina, photographing farms with a multi-generational history. I used these photographs to create a series of ceramic sculptures. Rather than people, my portraits focus on places, including details distinct to each location, details evocative of the spirit of each farm. Each sculpture is a landscape built of fields, fences, buildings, and crops. The colors are browns, blacks, and oranges, much like the soil and the skin of the people. My work has prompted long overdue conversations about this very rich history.
That was Sid Carpenter of Swarthmore College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.